This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Peter Dick, who is a chaplain at Provenient Covenant Hospital. We're going to be talking about what life is like as a hospital chaplain. Now, you've mentioned to me that you've come just this afternoon from a memorial service. So one of the problems with work being at a hospital is that some people don't make it. And chaplains need to respond to families in those times of crisis. Does that give you pause?
Well, it's a I've experienced it as a huge privilege.
Really?
And where the focus is not only on the person who has passed, but also on the loving context of that person, family, friends. And so it's a both and for me, as opposed to just focusing on the death.
And of course, hospitals are also where people get born.
Yeah, a goodly number. I don't that's not one of my areas, but Jenny Conran, who that's her forte, and she's pretty tickled to be part of that part of it.
So tell us, how long have you been a hospital chaplain?
Well, I've been a hospital chaplain since about 1989. I was the first, staff chaplain at that time, Carl Pavilion, and I worked with the New Choice and psychiatric units there. But in 1992, I went to then Provenient Covenant, Mercy. No, it was Provenient Covenant then already. Provenient Covenant, where I've been since.
These hospitals sometimes change their names, don't they?
Yeah.
Now, Provenient Covenant is a hospital that has a Catholic tradition as well as a public hospital tradition. Tell us a little bit about that. Now, you happen to be Mennonite.
Let's see how to best answer that. I think that the Sisters of the Holy Heart of Mary have had this long tradition of being very inclusive of and reaching out into the community. It's I think they're definitely a very Catholic-based faith community.
Meaning universal, yes.
Yes, right. Yeah. And on our particularly our staff, we have Sister Mary Robert is our director, and then we have two lay Catholic chaplains, or actually they prefer that the term pastoral ministers be used. And then we have Jerry Nichols, who's one of our retired but now very active United Methodist pastoral minister, as well as a Missouri Synod Lutheran, Jeff McPike, who also fills in with call responsibilities, evening and over a weekend call.
What's your typical day like? You have a schedule. You're not there just day and night, although you were there Sunday afternoon today, of course.
Yeah. Well, typically the mornings begin with a treatment team. I serve as part of the treatment team on the behavioral health, or the we used to call the psychiatric unit, and that happens every day. I think it's one of the strengths that we have is that we have an interdisciplinary team that starts the day, and we review all our patients in our care. Then I make my way after that to the surgical waiting room, where I meet the families, particularly those families that are whose loved one is having bypass surgeries.
I or major surgery.
Major surgery.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And from there, I go to the intensive care unit. Those are my two primary areas: are behavioral health and intensive care, or we call it critical care. And spend most of my morning there, and then the afternoon is more on the psychiatric direction.
Now, the people who've come in do you deal mainly with patients or with families or both?
Well, in the intensive care area, that's where I spend most of my time with families and friends, because if they're in intensive care, they tend to be sedated or they're intubated with a breathing apparatus, and
sure.
So they're not much for conversation. But
right.
Really, that's I think if I had to do a let's say a to assess that, it'd be most of my time is with friends and family of the patients on that floor.
Now, when someone comes in with a loved one who's having surgery or who's in the intensive care unit, they may not expect to talk to a hospital chaplain. What if they don't want to talk to you?
Well, I at least meet and greet, but then they can politely or otherwise have me leave, and that's okay. That's, of course, everyone's right and privilege. I try to encourage them, and I do present myself as a spiritual caregiver as opposed to a Christian or Catholic, which a lot of folks tend to lump us together and say, well, you're here representing the Catholic Church, or you're a priest and specifically Christian. But really, I see myself, and most chaplains do see themselves as spiritual caregivers.
What does that mean?
That means that we are concerned about how people put this whole experience together from a values and emotional and intellectual basis. That when you go to the hospital, you're not just there with a disease or condition to address, but it's all involving. You know, if you've ever, I regret to say, I've never been a patient. But
don't regret it. Be thankful.
Well, it's sometimes a bit more real that way if you've been there yourself. But I think it's all consuming. It matters that you've had this, what a lot of folks see as a setback or as a detour. And people begin to ask questions of faith or of mortality, what life means now that this has happened. So it isn't just a in the hospital bed experience. Most people have such busy lives. The ones that either are the patients or their families, they don't know how am I going to fit this into my schedule. Now what am I going to do? Yeah. I don't have transportation. Yeah. And some folks come to us, and we have seen more and more of this, that some folks come to us and they have little or no resources for food. Even they spend their nights at the hospital. They may be out of work. And so we have to address the needs of families as well.
Now, hospitals typically in American history have nonprofit status, and there's been a great furor about that here locally with whether hospitals should pay property tax. You know, are they making too much money for somebody, or are they charitable institutions? You're suggesting that there's at least some charity going on to people who come in who have no resources, either as patients or as family or friends.
It's true. Most noteworthy, I think, is in the area of behavioral health, where a lot of our folks, really don't have the resources to pay. They don't have insurances, and yet they present with mental illness, and maybe a lot of them are suicidal. And so if it wasn't for the CHIPS program of the state of Illinois, I think it would be a gracious and not very strongly paying operation. A lot of our people in our care just don't have the resources to firsthand pay for their or have their insurances pay for their services.
And there's so many people without health insurance.
Right.
And I know hospitals still treat people even in intensive care for a long time who have nothing. Let me reintroduce our guest for people who may have tuned in later and give the phone numbers so listeners may call and join this conversation. Anywhere the program is heard, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates, you may use a local line, 333-9455. I see we have a call already on line number 4. Yes, Our guest is Peter Dick, a chaplain, a hospital chaplain. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, Peter. This is Steve, your seminary classmate from Eureka. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good. Steve.
The question I have is, how did your seminary training affect you and help you in preparing you for this role?
Oh, well.
Were there any specific classes on being a hospital chaplain?
Well, I think I'm faithful to my seminary and appreciate a lot of what a lot of the training and that I have received for specifically for hospital chaplaincy came either when I went to we did a what we called a congregationally supervised pastoral experience year, which was off-site, and also in clinical pastoral education, which again was during that year and beyond seminary. I think seminary did prepare me for knowing what I believed, knowing how I believed, and to begin the journey of in the ecumenical journey, which I think that chaplaincy is one of the. I mean, it's institutionalized ecumenism, as far as I'm concerned, and so. Without criticizing the seminary I went to, I think that I think they laid a good foundation. But Steve, thanks for asking the question.
Yeah. Okay. Good to hear you from.
Thanks for the call. We have another caller waiting. Before we get to that, what is institutionalized ecumenism? Ecumenism is a word that may not be familiar to all our listeners.
Well, it's the I see ecumenism as the becoming very aware of the broader Christian family of traditions. I see ecumenism primarily as within the Christian family. Interfaith, I would differentiate that from interfaith. And that's how – it's appreciating how people have felt called to follow Jesus Christ as in many ways. And I think that – well, I like to see that the hospital is the what I would call the spiritual spiritual crossroads of the community where faith and life and death come into they cross paths with many aspects of the community, meaning little C community, as in the Champaign-Urbana area.
Let's go to another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Reverend Peter Dick. Go ahead.
Yes, Reverend. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious. I have a great respect for what you do. But I'm curious. I'm a Taoist. I'm friends with a lot of Buddhists. How do you, when you come into contact with people who aren't necessarily of a Christian background, how is it that you kind of relate to them, or do you? Is that a challenge for you in relating to that, especially facing death and things and not necessarily believing in heaven, but a different form of afterlife or something along those lines? How is it that you relate to those individuals?
I try to connect with them in the sense that I need to know more about how their faith tradition gets implemented or how it's relevant to their being in the hospital. We try to establish what kind of social support, and including that is also including spiritual support. Is there a faith community that we can remind you of and connect for you? Sometimes people come to the hospital and they either forget or they don't want to bother the religious cleric or whatever. And so we try to cultivate that. I try to encourage that person to let me know how it is that this matters to you as a Taoist or as a Buddhist or as an apostolic Christian or whatever spiritual constructs we're using, even if it's agnostic or atheist. Or I've had some really great conversations with people who are atheist and then but they are often very willing to, or even like white witches or whatever, willing to talk about what in the world this illness, how it relates to their sense of well-being, their hopeful, the dimension of hope that they have, how they're making sense of it, and who's in it with them. And so, I can't remember when I had a Taoist person, you know, people who are Hindus, you know, we have Hindus doctors on staff, and so and Muslim, and it really becomes a great opportunity to really embrace and to discover from each other how life and health and death and illness, how they're made sense of and how they lead on to more purposeful living. There is meaning in death. There is meaning in suffering. There is meaning in whatever brought you into the hospital.
Mm. Well, thank you very much.
Before you go, caller, if I could just be a little curious, is there a Taoist community in Champaign-Urbana?
I know several Taoists. Nothing too specific. Sometimes it'll come across in some of the martial artists. It's almost kind of a anti-Taoist sentiment to be necessarily of a community or to have a church, so to speak.
Of course, yeah. But I was just wondering what the challenge would be for a hospital chaplain if you were facing, you know, one of these very serious surgeries. Who might they call on who would be helpful to you since as you say, your community is almost anti-community?
Well, I don't know if there would actually be someone specific. Uh-huh. Although that being said, I'm friends with a priest here in town. Friends with, you know, it's really almost anyone.
Sure. Okay.
You know, so.
Well, thank you.
In another sense, everyone is a community.
All right.
Oh, okay.
So, well, thank you very much, and be well.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Peter Dick, who is a chaplain at Provena Covenant Hospital. We're talking about his life as a chaplain. He talked about being a spiritual caregiver in a very interfaith setting. And as you mentioned, the people who work for hospitals, doctors, nurses, administration, all sorts of other folks come from many different backgrounds, even though Provena Covenant has this Catholic tradition that it grows out of. And still runs the hospital. Some people may not think of a group of Catholic sisters as being that open to. Is that prejudice? Ignorance? What?
I think it is a little bit. as with a lot of things that we don't know about, where suspicion tends to run high, or we become fearful or whatever, however we deal with the stranger, the different than us. I've been very, very, very impressed by with my friends down the street and at the convent. I think they have certainly shown great sensitivity towards my tradition, which happens to be non-sacramental, and so very, very sensitive that that nothing be asked of me that is very, very Catholic. I mean, we show great deference to each other in terms of respecting how we are differently called to express our following of God, and really, I think there's a lot to. I wish sometimes we had an agency for helping the sisters to market being in religious life, because I think there's a great strength there that is nationally maybe seen a decline. And so, but I think that kind of committed and devoted life from a religious standpoint is my own tradition. We many, many years ago, we did also have an order of deaconesses that were committed to health and expressed themselves in terms of health care. And it's quite a calling. I see it as the same calling and no less of a calling than you and I, Steve, who come from what we would call mainline, or, well, we're not mainline, you are. But
Peter's referring to the fact that my training is as a Presbyterian minister. and he is a Mennonite. And now I would describe myself as a Christian, a Protestant, a Presbyterian, liberal, progressive, mainline, whatever. But when we were talking earlier, you said that Mennonites don't consider themselves Protestants. Now, when I studied church history, I thought the way we categorized Mennonites was on the part of the radical Reformation, the Mennonite tradition. Mm. Now, would you define it outside of the Reformation entirely?
I don't think so. I'm not as well read as I wish I was, but historically and theologically, there's a strong commitment to the fact that we were not part of those that were protesting, and this is something that was original of sorts, and the advent of the Anabaptist reformers, and so it's not a big deal, I guess. For simplicity, I think we're in our culture here, we're pretty used to the fact that you're either, if you're a Christian, you're either Protestant or Catholic, and I guess
or some, Orthodox. Or,
yeah, well, okay, Orthodox, yes. I have friends who are Orthodox.
But Mennonites and Amish brothers and sisters, sort of, or cousins, would typically say, well, we weren't really protesting against the Catholic Church at that time, but we became separate.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, the Anabaptists and the Anabaptists came first, by the way, you know that. And some folks simplistically think that the Mennonites came out of the Amish, but actually the verse is true. And let's see. I'm drawing a...
It's hard on live radio to remember everything you've learned in your career, I know.
Yeah.
So the Amish came out of the Mennonite, which came out of the Anabaptist tradition of the Reformation period.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And people... So I recently came through some of the Amish lands, talking with some Amish people, and went to the Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola,
right.
Illinois, a fascinating place,
mm-hmm.
And where you can learn about the Amish culture. Do Mennonites have anything similar?
Yes, there is a in the Metamora area. There is a historical museum, and also there is a in the I would call it sometimes the Mennonite ghetto of Goshen, Indiana, where we have a college close by in Shipshawana, which is there are a lot of Amish there. There is a special interpretive center for including Mennonites and Amish, but it's in Shipshawana, and right now the name escapes me, but it's there.
And I don't know where Metamora is.
Metamora is east and north of us.
It's in Illinois.
Yes, it's okay. Not far from Eureka, I believe.
Okay. So although our advertised topic is hospital chaplaincy, if people have questions about Mennonites or Amish, you can answer them all.
Well, I don't think so. One of your prior guests, I think, would be a better source for that. And if anyone has any Mennonite questions, then I will take their name and pass that on. Yeah. I consider mine one of the best jobs I could ever have. I've never regretted my calling to this because of it's like, why do people go to movies? Because I think they want to gain an entrance into the lives of others that's different than their own.
Sure.
And that's what it's been for me. It's like going to the movies and getting paid for it. Huh. And each day there's something brand new. I have no 2 days in a row that are the same.
Huh.
And there's a lot of challenges. We're facing a lot of ethical challenges these days, especially in pastoral care, with because our technology is able to do so much, and we're beginning to ask a lot more ethical questions in terms of the direction of medical care. When is it time to stop, and under what circumstances do we continue care? More and more hospital systems are encouraged to have ethics committees that help people to decide, because we're not all that very experienced at making those kinds of decisions. They don't come along every day. And for some folks, there's a real wrestling, and we try to cultivate a reflective coming at it from different angles in terms of values and precedents and so forth as to how people make their decisions about when and how to provide health care.
Should people make those decisions before it's a crisis time?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm very proud to say that my own congregation will be looking at this later this fall as to begin talking more seriously about matters of life and death. We don't get there aren't too many advocates, very verbal, I mean, in-your-face kind of advocates who are saying that we need to talk about power of attorney for health care and living will and organ donation. And yet the need is so huge, and the opportunities is quite great, but a lot of folks still have a lot of misconceptions about organ donation. I think the people that are living now because they've received organs are convinced, surely, but most of us, I don't know, Steve, are you willing to talk about death or not? And I mean, not that we dwell on it and say how great it is, but in the sense of that we're willing to say, one of these days our lives will end. And how are we going to do that in a responsible manner and not just leave it, dump our business onto the laps of those people who love us and are going to continue after our time?
If there are listeners who have questions or comments, give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number available to all who are hearing this, including people who listen on the internet at will.illinois.edu. In Champaign-Urbana, you can reach several local lines by punching in 333-9455 to talk with our guest, hospital chaplain Peter Dick. I brought that up just to avoid talking about death, of course. but let's do. What, in your experience, what are some of the biggest mistakes people have made in not planning for the fact that they might die? Not having a living will, not having someone with the power of attorney for health concerns, not making decisions to share their vital organs if they were to be in an accident or whatever?
Well, especially the latter, then a lot of – we go around embalming and burying a lot of really wonderful treasures.
Kidneys that would keep other people alive.
Exactly. We've seen a fair bit of that. But, you know, on the other hand, we have had very recently there was a donation of from one person that I'm happy to say that there were, you know, kidneys were harvested as well as a liver, I believe. And again, there's not a lot of venues where we get a chance to say, this is really great. You know, look at this life that was spared. I have a friend that lives not far from here who's walking around now because he did get a heart. And but I guess it's one of my personal ministry desires is to be more vocal about it. You know, we know that we just have to find a good venues for that. It's hard, but I think churches, and this is a little announcement, that if some of us are willing to come and talk about the possibilities of taking care of business of good stewardship of the bodies that some of us call the temple of God. You know, we've wasted a lot of temples and put them in the ground. And I know that some religious traditions are not supportive of that, but that's all right. I mean, that's...
But for those who do, information may be helpful, and you're saying you and other local hospital chaplains around...
I'm sure.
...might be a good resource for that.
Yes, indeed.
So synagogues, churches, mosques, whatever, who would want information can get it.
Right, and... Perhaps some pastors, you know, some pastors do find it difficult to talk to on a Sunday morning about what we believe about death and dying.
Right.
It's not the most how shall we say?
Cheerful.
Cheerful discussion topic or sermon topic.
But NPR listeners, public radio listeners, they're sturdy souls.
They're not typical. No.
That's right. They're very realistic. They know this. Yeah. This is an important topic and can be very helpful to people. Tell us a little bit about some of your experiences with some of the happier things. People often come out of near-death experiences with stories. Do they tell you?
You mean like the it's like the light at the end of the tunnel?
Sure, those sorts of things, or even even things that seem miraculous.
Yeah,
and perhaps are.
Well, we have folks who come back onto the critical care unit, and they're walking and talking and are dressed in street clothes, and that is huge for a lot of our people, because some people do go there. They knock on death's door for quite a few days, and sometimes we don't know where it's going to lead. But we've had some good success stories, quite a few actually, and where people we thought that were not going to make it, and some doctors are granted the wisdom to have a second sight, as it were, to say, keep on going, don't stop. And but it's a wrestling, it's an art, it's a medical science, and is healing is something that we are not always, you know, totally in control of. We don't know, because we don't. I'm convinced, and maybe some of our medical people may not agree, but I'm convinced that there's so much we cannot measure, we cannot address, because people and patients and their friends are stuck in a wait and see, wait and hope, wait and pray and cry and hope. And those, you know, nobody like that isn't, that's like fishing and not catching any fish every minute. It's quite a challenge, and a lot of people grow. I've been tempted, if I had the ability to do a lot of research, I would try to do follow-up visits with some of our people, too, especially the people that have experienced bypass surgery or bypass and or valve surgery on their hearts. Because, like it or not, physically we are, you know, spiritually we are impacted by physical circumstances. If you assault the body or insult the body with surgery, then post surgery, sometime it varies from person to person. But we've noticed that people see that as a loss. There has been the body's integrity has been changed, and then there people experience a grief process, even if they're able to walk and talk and chew.
Even if the surgery was a success.
Even if it was a great success, something happened. And it's like the body gets angry that it's been invaded like that for our own good, I think, for their own good.
We're about halfway through our program today with our guest, Peter Dick, from Provena Covenant Hospital, one of the several chaplains there. He comes from a Mennonite tradition and has been serving in a Catholic hospital before, has served in other hospitals. We'll be getting back to some questions with him in just a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I'm the director of the University YMCA for about another 3 weeks before my retirement, and then Willard Broom will be taking over as an interim director there. The Y is been on this campus for 136 years. We're the oldest charity in Champaign County. We've been providing services to university students and faculty here at the university for all these decades. And we have many different programs. One of the big ones we have coming up is a huge recycling program. Students for Environmental Concerns is one of our Y programs that's been very active for over 30 years and made many great contributions to recycling and environmental education at the university and abroad. And one of the programs that has grown out from some of those concerns at the Y is our big dump and run collections and sale of items that people might have no use for, but others might value very much. We've talked about the importance of organ donation. Well, we don't receive human organs, but we receive about everything else, from cars and trucks and motorcycles to furniture and all kinds of things, household goods. And we'll be collecting at the University of Illinois Stock Pavilion more items, particularly furniture we're eager to get because of so much need for that as new students arrive at the university, particularly from other countries. So if you have something to donate, you may bring it to the Pennsylvania Avenue Stock Pavilion Wednesday through Friday, August 13 to 15, from 9 till 6, and then Saturday, August 16, from 9 till noon, Monday, August 18, from 12 to 8, Tuesday, August 19, from 9 to 4, and then our huge sale will open at that pavilion August 23, 24, and 25. That's a Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And so we start on Saturday, August 23rd for the sale at 8 in the morning. So people who want some great bargains, and we do get all kinds of things. We've had people find first edition books there and fascinating CDs and records. And oh, we have just an amazing number of things. So again, the collections start at the Stock Pavilion Friday, August 13 to 15, from 9 to 6, and then the 16th, 18th, and 19th. If you have questions, do call the University YMCA, 337-1500, or check out our website, universityymca.org, and you'll see Dump and Run. Some of the guests coming up on Keeping the Faith, and then weeks ahead, next week, Mark Johnson, National Director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, an international peace organization. That's August 3rd. On August 10th, our guest will be Professor Mohammed Khalil, Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Illinois, one of several, one of two, I should be precise. On August 17, Bill Timaeus, a writer for the Kansas City Star and a blogger whose blog is called Faith Matters, will be our guest by phone. We look forward to those guests here on Keeping the Faith and encourage listeners to give us a call if you have a question or a comment, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. And I see we have a caller on line number one. Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say a thank you also to Peter for the various ways in which he works for race relations within our community and strong advocate within the Ministerial Alliance. And I'm very, very grateful for that because while we talk about organ donations, he certainly has put his heart very much into this community and in working toward the better race relations. And I'm very thankful for that.
Well, thank you for that good word.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. So why are you interested in race relations?
Well, I can tell you how. I don't know about why. I think back in 1992, that's when it started, and I think we, although it was, I think I felt the urgings before then, but in 1992, that was the year of the Rodney King fiasco in California. And I, at the time, I was involved in the Ministerial Association, the Champaign-Urbana Ministerial Association. And that's when my friend and colleague, Reverend Charles Nash, and I we began the Religious Leaders for Community Care. I'm not a very precise historian, forgive me for that. But and that's where our relationship developed. And
was an interracial group of clergy and other religious leaders.
We saw ourselves as having a ministry of racial reconciliation.
Okay.
And that has continued, although the organization has dwindled and is not really formally existent any longer, but there's old hearts are still beating true there. And I am a member, a proud member of the Ministerial Alliance of Champaign-Urbana and Vicinity, where Reverend Dr. Evelyn Underwood is the president currently, and I'm serving on, I serve on their executive. It's you know, you, we've developed friendships and over the years, and if you have a friend that's not getting a fair shake in things, or that harm is coming to your friends, then it takes on a different life, becomes much more it's oriented to other folks, in addition to just, you know, the old adage of me, my friend, me and my wife, my son and his wife, us four and no more, just is not what's usual and customary. We have to, if you own people, as it were, they are part of you, and that's where the racial ministry or racial involvement is now. It's, I think, to believe that racism is diminished, or it has evolved. It's not gone. It's still there, much more sophisticated than ever before, and it's just become part of me. We cannot ignore that. As much as you'd like to, sometimes you wish that there was a better world, but it just and a lot of us are grown tired because there are no more. It's not as dramatic as it used to be with cross burnings and lynchings and the like, but it still exists in exclusionary and bigoted attitudes towards people, and actually harmful relationships that are not illegal, but they're harmful.
And as you mentioned, there are still in this country, it seems to me particularly in the North, very few friendships across racial lines.
Yeah.
Very few. We have a caller waiting on line number one. Other callers are invited to join us, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Yes, line number one.
Yes, Steve. I wanted to say how wonderful it is to hear Peter Dick and to know that the tradition is being carried on. Our world needs it desperately. Thank you. Oh, I know.
Well, I recognize that voice of Jan Shepherdson.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, Jan, you've been so faithful to this program and to Ward's ministry in the community, and I want to just let you know I appreciate that very much.
And a former nurse who also knows the value of hospital chaplains, mm-hmm. and she worked with hospice for many years.
Yes.
So it's always encouraging to hear from Jan. We, on Keeping the Faith, have had many listeners over the years. This is the ninth year of this program, and I felt privileged to be able to talk to so many fascinating people about topics that are important. When I was in college, I had a friend who would often say when we'd meet for dinner, "Well, what have you been thinking about that's important today?" Mm. And, you know, he kind of pushed aside some of the trivial things and wanted to know, you know, had you been thinking at all about something that might matter? Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the things that gave you pleasure about your job, and one thing you said that surprised me was that I knew that things were different every day, but I didn't think about the possibility that the very variety of things would be mm-hmm. such a pleasure, because so many of the things seem horrible.
Well, that's why I was saying, you know, it's like going to the movies. It's a different story every day and different characters. You never see some of the
And you have a part, you're involved in their lives.
Yes.
Are people more open at the time, like a hospital?
Sometimes.
And some are more, go away and leave me alone.
Well, various people respond to loss and all the stress of loss in such a variety of ways. And that leads to people are very angry at the time of loss, and some people are destroyed at the time of loss, and some people just don't know what to do. And that's where a lot of the variety comes from, but that's where we also get a chance. Some people are not open to our care. And that's, as I said earlier, I think that is their choice. But We just I there have been some vignettes of as I think back over some of the situations I've been part of, and I guess the thing that is most rewarding is where you see great love shown amongst people, and that's is where our and by, that means by our staff. I remember one situation where we had a mom came to a single parent mom came to our emergency, and this is quite some time ago. And she had a young teen son who had nobody in town, nothing. Our staff was very, very caring. And I mean, this is a teenager who had this boy who had lots to do and wanted to do lots of stuff. And we, between our nurses, our security personnel, and myself, we took care of that kid too. And just seeing that, again, beyond the scope of the immediate of just the illness, I think that, and seeing the wonder that is there. We are all vessels of life, and I think the Almighty watches over us all, especially those of us who have great blessings, to see what we're going to do when one of God's other creations comes along with profound need. I think that God is watching, you know, all the time. And just as I would, if one of my kids got into trouble, I would want to see who is relating to them, and be ever so pleased. And when they were being shown love, and you know, they were being appreciated spiritually, it's very intense sometimes. I remember we had a young little Amish baby who we were not able to revive, resuscitate, and I'll never forget the image of that of the mom in the poorly lit. It happened. We turned down the lights in one of the emergency department rooms, and how she sat there with this little boy that was perfect in every way, except the life was not there anymore.
Wow.
And I hope this doesn't sound morbid, but it was just such a sight of beauty of people really caring for people. And I think we there are so many opportunities for doing that, not just the hospital, but other places where and the people who do the caring are truly, I think, blessed. This is a time of blessing. It's not time of pain, but a time of blessing when we care for people that are having difficulty of some kind.
You mentioned that the hospital setting is, I think your words were, spiritual crossroads of the community, because we all go there sometime or other, usually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, it's very seldom we don't get sick sometime. And since we all go there, I guess one thing I wonder is, how do you get your resources to continue? I mean, it must be wearing on you to just to have to keep responding to so many different people. Yes, you enter their lives, and that's a privilege, and you give thanks for it, but where do you get the spiritual stamina?
Well, part of it is for my own congregation, where, although I, you know, don't disclose facts and figures and whatever, but the essence of it is shared. And so people, and me just being able to share what I sometimes carry, that provides for some measure of, let's say, of grief relief for myself. And
and you have a pastor there that's your pastor.
Right, oh. Yeah. And friends,
sure,
all kinds of friends in the community that who know of the experience and are able to, I can debrief at times. But again, you know, not to minimize how that can touch me. I mean, after a while, you have to, if I sense that I'm, and there's always the great temptation of becoming jaded about human nature.
Be hardened or callous.
Hardened or callous. And, you know, I think a lot of times we,
have to watch for that. I think the recently, if I may say this, the recently released motion picture, The Dark Knight, there is a scene in there where the Joker is totally fooled by human nature. And I think that there's always where he has become jaded and about because of painful experience of his past. I don't want to break the whole movie here, but I think that we oftentimes have to remember that we all need to be loved and to also to exercise love. And that's part of how we can cope with. I get a chance to love a lot of folks. And
well, let's do a little recruiting here. You mentioned that there are fewer and fewer folks seemingly choosing the path of being a part of a religious order, a nun, a priest. That's also true in other religious traditions, Christian and otherwise. It's hard that when you're in college to think, well, I could be a lawyer and get this huge salary. I could be, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. why would I choose something that's probably not going to pay very well? Has where the hours are long, the pressure is huge. Why would I choose to be a religious leader?
A religious leader.
What would you tell a young person?
Well, I told one of my daughters that she should weigh very carefully about becoming a minister, not because it's bad or anything like that, but because you really, I'm of the conviction that a sense of calling is, in other words, spiritual relevance for your task, your work, is what makes ministry possible. And I'm not a great recruiter about congregational ministry. I guess I think that's very important, and I certainly value the leadership in our particular congregation. I mean, I think that helping people to grow and become more of what God has intended for them and what would want for them is the greatest kind of work there is. Again, pastoral ministry or congregational ministry has become such an intense field, but so is everything else that's worthwhile. There are more and more people that are knocking on our door wanting to be chaplains.
Really?
And so people who go through the clinical pastoral education programs, I mean, just put a plug in for them under the direction of Jim Wingem at Carl Foundation Hospital, but also at Bill DeLong at Broman Bloomington Normal.
Bloomington, sure.
Yeah, folks are...
So these would be pastors who'd been to seminary, and then they get this added training in clinical pastoral work.
Education, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great a need for them, and they're actually persons with those kinds of skills are also becoming involved in business settings where people realize that spiritual care belongs in a business setting where we deal with ethical issues and how we enter into those are from our own value systems and how
in relationships. And dealing with other people. Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's huge. I think no matter where that's the beauty of chaplaincy and pastoral care, you know, there are so many different settings, such a great, wonderful variety, whether it's in corrections or whether it's in geriatric facilities or in airports, just a huge variety, and much like nursing. Nursing is so versatile, not to exclude medicine, but we have a lot of opportunities there.
What skills does it take to be a spiritual counselor?
A spiritual counselor?
Yeah, let's make it as broad as possible. I was going to say, you know, a hospital chaplain, but I think it carries over.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think, let me just add that the related field of spiritual direction, and there are a number of spiritual directors in our community, people are beginning to want more of and to grow, no matter what their age, to grow and to become members of the community that seek to cultivate a health in spiritual health. I think people have to have a good grounding in their own particular sense of who they are, their spiritual sense, to become a pastoral counselor, a person willing to embrace life experiences. And if the experiences don't come to them, then they go pursue the experiences. I think that's what's required.
And if a young person is looking at themselves and wondering if they have what it takes, or if they're feeling a beginning of a call to this sort of a life, what might they look for?
They might look for opportunities to be of service. There's a lot of there are a lot of good. In various faith traditions, they have opportunities for service, to being in service to others, and where you get a chance to test out your faith and your practice and that of others, and to see if you have an acceptance, if you can accept that, if you can grow with others, and realize that there are differences in problems. The other folks' problems are not yours, but you are a companion for those problems, and it's one of those sacred holy moments when they're much like the burning bush experience, I think, of old, that things are happening, but you are not being consumed by that, but that you have a privilege. I guess I have to go back to the word I started from. It's a privilege to be to enter into the what's most meaningful, most sacred, most valued by a person.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Reverend Peter Dick, one of the hospital chaplains at Provena Covenant Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. My name is Steve Shoemaker, usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and next week we'll be talking with Mark Johnson by phone, who is a national director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation. We'll be talking with Mark about peace issues on August 10. Our guest will be Professor Mohammed Khalil from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign Religious Studies Program, talking about issues in Islam. He's a professor of Islamic Studies at the university. The week following, Bill Timaeus will be our guest. Reminder about Dump and Run coming up at the Stock Pavilion, collection dates starting August 13. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
When Josh Ritter is asked what kind of music he plays, he sometimes ends up lying. After all, it's hard to describe. A little bit rock and roll, by way of Bruce Springsteen, with a twist of Bob Dylan. Any way you describe it, Josh Ritter has arrived. In this hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll get inside the music of one of music's new stars. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7.
The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 1 a.m. Monday morning for these counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area in central Illinois, Christian, and Sangamon counties. This is WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Super Value, Champaign; Swires Land and Management Company, Danville; EAG Company Incorporated, Fairmount; and AgriGold Hybrids, Mohammed. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.